It's Friday, 12th of April, and this is your Capital Economics Weekly Briefing. My name's Neil Shearing, Group Chief Economist. David's out this week, so I'm joined instead by Mark Williams, our Chief Asia Economist, to pick through the week's events. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Neil.
Now, I know there's lots we could discuss, but I want to focus on Janet Yellen's visit to China and what we learned about the state of US-China relations and what the implications of those are for the global economy and for markets. Of course, Yellen wrapped up a visit earlier this week, having toured Beijing and Guangzhou. And it's clear, I think, that both sides are making an effort to repair relations. Yellen herself told reporters that US-China relations were, quote, on a much stronger footing than this time last year. And yet, obvious tensions remain. In a telephone conversation earlier this month between Xi and Biden, there were pointed exchanges about technology controls. And add to that, we have concerns about perceived overcapacity in China's manufacturing sector and the effect that's going to have on Western economies. So I want to dig into all of that. But just to start with, what's your high-level takeaway about the state of US-China relations as things stand?
Well, as you say, Neil, it's I guess, encouraging that the two sides are talking. They weren't talking not so long ago, before the summit in California between the two presidents at the end of last year. And it's also quite striking that they're talking and there's a kind of constructive tone to their comments, while at the same time, a lot of these points of difference are right there out in the open. So you've had US officials expressing concern about China's actions in the South China Sea. Yellen herself was talking about their concerns about China supplying Russia. And all this stuff, which has really just boiled up to the surface recently about Chinese overcapacity and the idea that China is flooding world markets. So it's not like they're sort of hiding their points of difference on any of these things. And yet, you know, conversations are ongoing. So yeah, definitely an improvement in the sort of the tone of the relationship over the past few months.
Yes, certainly an improvement in tone. But as you say, potentially a new area of tension emerging around what US and European governments perceive as Chinese overcapacity, particularly in the manufacturing sector. I think Chinese industrial output has increased by something like 25% since before the pandemic. And that reflects in part, I guess, investment that's gone in to Chinese capacity to meet pandemic-related demand for goods. But it's also, isn't it, part of a strategic decision by Beijing to expand into certain sectors like batteries and electric vehicles. And given that these firms are receiving substantial government support, the concern now is that that's going to feed into a flood of artificially cheap imports into Western economies. How valid do you think those concerns really are?
Well, first of all, I mean, we've been talking about overcapacity in China, overinvestment in China for, it's decades now, isn't it? Wen Jiabao was talking about it, the former Chinese premier in 2007. But he, you know, even by that point, this was a well-established point of discussion about China. It's been investing more than 40% of its income every year since the early 2000s. So this is a kind of a long-running issue, a perennial issue for China's economy. But it has become a bigger problem recently. It has definitely got worse over the past couple of years. Partly that's because of domestic weakness, of course. And a lot of the talk is about investment and the supply side of China's economy growing. But we shouldn't forget that when you're looking at a trade imbalance, it's also, you know, the weakness of demand within China that is feeding some of this. Most clearly, when we look at different sectors of China's economy, we can see overcapacity, perhaps obviously in areas that are linked to the property sector. And of course, that's not going to go away. You know, a huge share of global steel, iron ore, copper ultimately is going into Chinese property. So we're going to have lasting overcapacity in some linked areas. And the weakness of China's economy over the past couple of years has also exacerbated problems of overcapacity in, for example, the auto sector. Cars has been one of the key points of concern recently. And I think it's quite striking. If you look at output of vehicles from China's auto sector, it's only just got back at the end of last year to the level it was at in 2017. So essentially, there's been no growth in China's overall output of cars in six years. So, you know, that's really quite striking. And what's more, sales of cars within China are still 10% lower than they were in 2017. So a big part of the reason why China all of a sudden has emerged as this big exporter of cars is that weakness, 10% of cars aren't being sold in China. So unsurprisingly, Chinese automakers are looking for markets overseas. So part of it's on the demand side. But the underlying reason, as you say, for supply capacity increasing a lot recently has just been there's been a huge surge of investment that is partly strategic. The government has identified some sectors as being important for the future, whether that's EVs, batteries, green technology, and so on. But also, of course, given that this is an economy that invests 40% of income every year, and a big target of that investment, the property sector or related infrastructure, has been doing much worse, there's just been a push to invest more in other parts of the economy. So that we've seen investment going up across manufacturing, not just these targeted sectors.
Yeah, I want to get back to the weakness of domestic demand or domestic consumption, rather, in China and prospects for reform there. But just on what this means for the rest of the world, to start off with, I mean, in one sense, even though concerns about overcapacity might be valid, isn't this a strange thing for policymakers in the West to be worrying about, given that we've just lived through the biggest inflation shock for 40 years? This large expansion in global industrial capacity, surely that's going to help to reduce price pressures, isn't it? At least in global goods markets. Is it not the case that China's exporting, if not deflation, then disinflation to the rest of the world?
Yeah, definitely. In fact, it has been. So the latest figures suggest that the price of the typical export from China is about 12% lower now in dollar terms than it was a year ago. So we've already been feeling a disinflationary impact from imports from China around the world. And on top of that, the weakness in China's property sector is likely to mean that commodity prices are going to be lower in future. In fact, our commodities team have just lowered their forecast for commodity prices for those commodities that are linked to Chinese property. So, that's another disinflationary impulse that is coming from China for the rest of the world. So certainly, if you just concerned about inflation, this is a good thing. But Janet Yellen's concerns were more about the impact of a flood of Chinese goods on manufacturing sectors in the US. We saw in the early 2000s the impact of Chinese exports on manufacturing sectors in many places around the world. And I think we should also acknowledge that it's not just pure kind of macroeconomics that is behind some of these concerns. It's also that China now is competing in sectors that a lot of developed economies kind of thought they owned, high-end, cars and these kinds of things. And all of a sudden, there's a competitive threat from China. It was perceived to be fine when China was dominating, textiles and some electronic sectors that the West never dominated. But now it's kind of coming to eat their lunch as well.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. There's a large political element as well as an economic element here. Just on the prospect for reform then, if US and European governments are right to be concerned about overcapacity in China and the macro and political implications of that, what prospects are there for reform of China's economy such that it helps to kind of mitigate some of these concerns? I guess that the fundamental issue is that household consumption in China, as you say, is still about 40% of GDP. That compares to 65, 70% of GDP in most advanced economies. So savings rates in China are very high, and therefore there's this inherent reliance on investment as a source of demand in the economy. That's got to go somewhere. If it can't go into the property sector, it's finding its way into the manufacturing sector at the moment. So what prospects for a kind of meaningful reform of China's economy such that we shift towards lower rates of savings and investment and towards higher rates of household consumption?
So here's where this kind of better mood music, the idea that the relationship is on a firm footing, it feels to me that's a very shaky, unstable position that we've reached, because the US side seems to be pinning its hopes for a shift here on structural reform in China, on China doing things that are going to pull down the investment share, push up the consumption share of the economy. And frankly, we've been hearing these kinds of calls for the best part of 20 years. And the response of Chinese policymakers very clearly this week, several Chinese policymakers have come out and essentially said, look, this is just sour grapes from the US. There is not a problem here with Chinese manufacturing. There's a the issue is that Chinese manufacturers are more productive and they're more successful and they're out competing. And so, you know, we're not going to change. I don't see any suggestion from Chinese policy side that they feel that there is a structural problem in China's economy. And, you know, there's been no suggestion recently, for example, of doing the sorts of things that might boost consumer spending, whether that would be more handouts to consumers or boosting social spending by the government. You know, we had the budget just last month, and none of these things appear in there. So I don't really see any likely prospect of the structural reforms that the outsiders are suggesting are needed to fix the problem that they see in China's economy. And so therefore, I think it then comes back to the likes of the US government and also European governments to ask, well, what are they going to do then? Because if China is going to be continuing to, you know, have these massive increases in manufacturing output, and these governments are saying, well, we're not going to let them flood our markets and we're not going to let them squeeze out our industries, well, you know, what are they going to do about it? I think that we don't really have an answer to that question, because governments have really been unwilling to, you know, they can't find a good answer to that question. But people are talking about the tariffs. Obviously, Donald Trump is suggesting he's going to put significant tariffs on Chinese goods. But as to what the Biden administration will do about it, we don't really know.
Just on the response of Western governments, it strikes me that one way of thinking about this is that Western governments essentially just allowed this big surge of imports from China through the 2000s into their economies. And that was one reason behind low rates of inflation, of course. Of course, the politics now around this has shifted. And there's going to be, I think, some pushback, as you've suggested, to a big wave of a further wave of imports from China. So we get into the tariff territory, perhaps. What would be the implications of those tariffs? In the past, we've had this big wave of imports from China. It's been disinflationary in goods markets in Western economies. Is it likely that it's now inflationary because we get tariffs imposed, or is it just go back to being slightly neutral because the price of Chinese exports is falling because of overcapacity, but then that's broadly offset by the imposition of tariffs? How would a big tariff on China, say, impact goods inflation in the US?
Well, we've got a example, obviously, going back to the tariffs that Donald Trump put on China a few years ago. And I think somewhat to the surprise of many, that didn't seem to have a big impact on prices within the US. And there are a few reasons for that. The big one really is that the exchange rate adjusted to pretty much offset, you know, a really big chunk of those tariffs. So we saw a lot of weakness in the renminbi in 2018, such that in dollar terms, the prices of goods from China didn't really rise that much. And then on top of that, when you're buying a good from China in a US store, the import price is only a share of what you're paying. And for most goods, it's in the region of about half of the price you're paying in the shop is the actual price of the good that is imported into the US. So that then sort of halves the impact there again. And in many cases, firms within the US retailers were willing to absorb this small increase that remained in their margins. So we didn't really see much of an impact on inflation, if any impact on inflation, from the first round of tariffs. Of course, the result of that also was that there wasn't really any reason not to buy Chinese goods. So in that sense, the tariffs didn't really have a significant impact. We saw that China's share of global exports actually rose during the trade war with the US. I think, though, that we shouldn't take that as necessarily saying that tariffs will never have an impact on inflation, because it depends on how big they are. And if Donald Trump or any future US administration were to place much bigger tariffs on imports from China, so he's been talking about 60% tariffs, a tariff of that scale, I think it's very unlikely that the People's Bank would allow the renminbi to depreciate to fully offset that kind of tariff. So if there were really big tariffs put on, I think we would see an inflation response for goods in final markets. That is, of course, just a one-off move, though. You know, once the tariff has been set higher, the price takes a step up on the shelf. But the following year, it doesn't take another step up. So you'd get a one-off bump to inflation. It wouldn't last. And then after that year is out, that we'd probably be back to, you know, a disinflation impact.
So potentially there are different response this time around, given the scale, scope of the measures potentially under consideration, and of course the potential for an offset from the currency. I know that you and the team have written extensively about that. We'll post links to those pieces in the podcast notes. So just to wrap up, the kind of $64,000 question, I guess, is if we roll the clock forward 5 years, how will all of this have played out and what the consequences be for the global economy? Obviously, it's an impossible question to answer, but what's your best sense of how this develops from here?
Well, we can get a bit of a clue here from what's happened in previous waves of overcapacity in China. So, you know, as I said at the beginning, this is not a new issue. It's been coming and going for a couple of decades now. And what often happens is when, after there's been a surge of investment into a given industry, is that you end up with overcapacity. And then at some point, the government steps in and tries to consolidate, squeezes out the weaker, and allows some firms to go under. So I think we're likely to see a bit of that. That would be the way that, from the Chinese perspective, some of these concerns about overcapacity will be dealt with. But from an overall kind of in aggregate, I don't see enough capacity being closed down to completely solve the problem. So I think it's still going to be a lingering concern. As things stand, it's going to be an issue that's going to continue for a very long time. The Chinese government is not going to step back from wanting to compete with developed economies in many sectors, particularly in those sectors that it thinks are strategically important. So we're going to have a lot of tension. I think the big question that would determine how things look in 5 or 10 years time is ultimately, how do Western governments respond to this? Do they find ways to prevent Chinese firms from selling in their markets? Do they insist that you can only sell your EVs from plants that you've located, you know, near us? Does BYD have to build a plant in Mexico or in Hungary, for example, and can't export from China? Or do Western governments just come down much harder and just find some way to block these firms from selling at all? So essentially just a protectionist response. If they don't do that, then it's going to be, I think, extremely hard for Western firms to be competing against the Chinese companies that in many cases have access to cheap capital. They're able to roll over loans. They have government support. And we shouldn't forget are also, you know, extremely successful, productive companies in many cases, and you know, will be a formidable competitive challenge.
Okay, so lots of uncertainty, but I guess the one thing we can be reasonably certain about is that this is not an issue that's going to go away quickly. And I guess that also means you're going to have a busy 3, 4, 5 years ahead of you too. Thanks very much, Mark.
Thanks, Neil.
That was Mark Williams on the state of US-China relations and what it means for the rest of the world. I'll post the reports that Mark and I discussed and referred to in the podcast page. I'll also include work we've done on the US election and on US-China fracturing too. Over the coming week, we're going to be holding some short-form online drop-ins, looking at the outlook for global markets. That's this coming Wednesday. You can register on the events page of our website. And all of our analysis, our events, our data, and much more is available as part of a CE Advance subscription, which you can learn more about at our website, www.capitaleconomics.com. For now, though, thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you again next week.
Whilst this podcast is provided with all reasonable skill and care, it comprises the subjective views of our economists. Furthermore, these views are not opinions, nor do they constitute investment or financial advice, or are they guarantees or reassurances to the expected results of any investment products or outcome. You should seek your own specific advice in relation to questions you may have. We will have no liability to you in relation to this podcast whatsoever.